This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
When the world is calling, whether it's sunny beaches, global cities, or boardrooms that can't wait, getting there starts here. With over 55 nonstop destinations, a new nonstop to Montreal on Air Canada, and 20 nonstop flights a day to New York City, Columbus makes travel simpler, smarter, and closer than you think. Start your trip at flycolumbus.com.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. All right, I'm joined today by Connie Walker. She is an award-winning investigative journalist. She was the host of the podcast Missing and Murdered, and she is also the host of a newer podcast called Stolen. Connie, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So where are you at? Are you in, I know you're Canadian. Are you in Canada?
Yeah, I'm in Toronto. It's rainy here today.
It's been rainy. Yeah, They predicted rain for us for like 2 weeks straight, and so I didn't turn my sprinkler system on, and then my lawn completely died, and then I turned my sprinkler system on, and now it's raining. It's been raining for 3 days ever since.
That's the way it goes.
Yep. So before we get into your podcast, tell me about a little bit about yourself. So you don't work anymore, but you used to work for the CBC?
Yeah, I worked at the CBC for almost 20 years, or for about 20 years. Yeah, I was there for a long time. I got that job right out of... I was an intern, and then I basically just never left until I did leave in 2019 during Gimlet.
Gotcha. So one of my all-time favorite podcasts is a CBC podcast, Someone Knows Something with David Ridgeon.
David, yes.
Yeah. You do. I take it you know David?
Yes, I know David. David and I worked together like years before we did podcasts on a TV show called CBC News Sunday, and it was like a news and current affairs style show, and David was a VJ, a video journalist, and I was a reporter producer, and we only kind of did one story together, but I've known David for a really long time. He's great.
Oh yeah, I love that. I've always loved his show. That I got to meet him once at CrimeCon, and then I interviewed him for True Crime Binge. It's been a year and a half ago now, but yeah, he's one of my heroes in the true crime podcasting space. He's just an amazing guy.
For sure.
So what else did you do for CBC?
I did everything for CBC. Honestly, like I worked there for so long, I got to do so many different kinds of things. I started out as an intern. My next job right after my internship was hosting a national youth television show. And then after I did that, I kind of realized that I needed to learn how to be a journalist. So I went back and I was an associate producer and then a reporter and then a producer. And I worked in news, current affairs, investigative, documentary. I even did I hosted a lifestyle show for about 6 months at CBC once. So I did.
You've literally done it all for them.
I love CBC for so many reasons, but I liked working at CBC because it really felt like there were opportunities to do lots of different kinds of things. And that there were also like just, you know, a lot of really creative, talented people who also really caring about the work that we were doing and the journalism we were doing. So it was great for me. And then when I actually started working on podcasting, you know, I had the first podcast, I was new to audio. I'd never done I was a TV reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Went out on a TV story and I was like, I think this could be a podcast. And I actually met with David. I came back to CBC.
Oh, yeah?
I was like, does this sound like a podcast to you? I don't know. But then I really kind of fell in love with podcasting. And I realized that, especially for the kind of stories that I'm interested in doing and the kind of things that I like to do, it really is the best. Best medium.
Yeah, I found, I've gone the other, I went from podcasting to doing some TV work and hate it and love coming back to podcasts. But it seems like the other one, the idea of not having time restrictions and such like tight parameters on everything makes it so, especially in the true crime space, it makes it so much easier, not easier is not the right word, but it's better to tell the kinds of stories that we're telling, especially like long form stuff like you're doing.
Yeah, it is. Although I feel that like my experience in news and the training I kind of had doing news has really helped me in podcasting as well. You know, like I feel,
right.
You know, having to just, you know, I was a local news reporter for a long time. So I was just doing a news story every day for a while. And I just feel like that kind of just trains you to talk to lots of different kinds of people, to do lots of different kinds of stories, but also just the, you know, every day filing a story is such a helpful thing when it comes to even, you know, now doing, 30 or 40 minute episodes of like a narrative podcast.
Yeah,
it's true. But I also, it would be hard to imagine going back. I would say that.
Yeah. My thing is just, so coming the other way was just doing the podcast, and I didn't have any background in this. So it's like, I'm 7 years in, still trying to learn all those skills that you've brought into the podcasting space with you. But it was always just like, I've got whatever this week's topic is, I can dig in and research and allow. And if it takes 22 minutes, that's okay. And if it takes an hour and 22 minutes, that's okay. And then when I went to do like my documentary, it was like, nope, we have 6 minute segments and this is when the ad breaks are. And it's just a whole different medium. It was tough for me to learn. I didn't enjoy it, as you can tell, very much at all. It's actually why I was a minute late. I was talking to my producers about some updates in the case. We worked on that, and they're wanting to do some more like follow up on it. And I'm just like, can I just talk about it? Do we need to do it on TV again?
I know, it's true.
So I take it you went to school to be a journalist. Was that what you always wanted to do?
Not really. Like, I mean, I think I was always interested in journalism, but really when I started university, I was studying arts. Like I was actually studying psychology and, I didn't, for whatever reason, I just didn't think like, I really didn't think I was going to get into the journalism school. So I was like, I'll do art. And, like I was also interested in psychology. And then at one point, I got connected with one of the communication programs that I could take alongside my arts degree. And that was kind of my way into journalism and storytelling. And then that's how I got my internship at CBC. I think that I was always interested in journalism, though in high school, like one of the first stories that I did for the school paper was about an Indigenous woman who had been killed in Saskatchewan. And I remember writing something for the paper. Her name was Pamela George, and I didn't know her, but you know, when she was killed, there were two white university students who were on trial for her murder. And it was a really high profile case in the province at the time. And I was paying attention, even though I don't think I was a kid who paid much attention to the news back then, honestly, but I was paying attention. I remember feeling, so upset by the way that she was talked about in the media and how, so much of the focus was on the two white university students who were charged in her death. You know, they were, one was called a basketball star. The other was a hockey standout. And they came from like middle-class families. And one of their dads worked at the university. And like, And Pamela was called like a prostitute. And we didn't know anything about her life. She was a young mom to two kids. And I just remember feeling so upset about the way that, you know, she was further dehumanized in the media, in this trial of the two men who were charged with her death. And they ended up being acquitted of murder and convicted of manslaughter. And I think that for a young, like I was a young Indigenous woman growing up in Saskatchewan, you know, I feel like that was such a chilling case to see, like, what happened to, or what didn't happen to them. You know, they it's a really kind of terrible case in so many ways. But, you know, like, they admitted to picking her up and taking her outside of the city, and they admitted to beating her and leaving her there, and they were acquitted in her murder, you know? And I felt like it spoke to how, not just how that jury and judge viewed Pamela's life, but about how broader society, the media coverage, how broader society viewed all of our lives as Indigenous women. And that was the first time I wrote something for the school paper and thought about becoming a journalist. But I also really felt like it wasn't a space for me. I remember thinking, like, are there any Native journalists, like, who are covering this trial or working at any of the papers? And there were few and far between, for sure, back then.
That's cool that you got your start there, because that's been a big focus of your work since then now. And it, you mentioned a couple times that you're an Indigenous woman yourself. You're part of the Cree Nation, is that right?
Yeah, I'm Cree.
Okay. And so you've made a big through, because the Missing and Murdered podcast focused on missing and murdered Indigenous women, and Stolen, your first season of Stolen did the same. It's great that you've continued on that work.
It took a long time though. Like, that was, so that the thing I wrote in high school, like, I graduated in 97. So that would have been like the mid, I think it was grade 11, maybe 96. And then, you know, it was like around 15 years at CBC before I was able to do that kind of coverage. And I think that for just the reality was, for a long time, there was just very, I think it's still true now, you know, like there's an attitude, I think, in newsrooms and in journalism that these stories are not as important, or that people don't care about them, or that they don't deserve our attention. Like, the first MMIW story I pitched was back in 2006. And I remember it because I was working on that show with David Ridgen. I heard about a girl who I knew from back home who had gone missing. And it was before social media. It was before Facebook or Twitter. And her family had sent out an email chain asking people to forward it. You remember that?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
In the 2000s, you're like, please forward this email. Please forward this email chain. And it was because they were trying to get attention because Amber had disappeared. And so I was working in this national newsroom in downtown Toronto, and she went missing near where I grew up in small town Saskatchewan. And her case barely got any local coverage. And I remember that same summer, another woman went missing in Toronto, and her name was Alicia Ross. And she was there were so many similarities I felt between Amber's disappearance and then Alicia's disappearance, because they were both these young women who kind of just seemed to disappear without a trace, and their families were so desperate for information. But Alicia, who went missing just north of Toronto in Markham, her case was covered on the national newscast, and like, her paper was on the front of the national newspapers here in Canada. And she was blonde and white, and Amber was a young Indigenous woman in Saskatchewan. And I remember going in and wanting to do a story about the media coverage of these two different cases and kind of examining why they were so different. And the executive producer at the time just had no interest. You know, I went into pitch, and she held up her hand to me, and she was like, this isn't another poor Indian story, is it? You know, and that was the attitude, I think, for a really long time, unfortunately. And I think it's still something that we're struggling with.
I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad. and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
It's tax season, and by now, I know we're all a bit tired of numbers, but here's an important one you need to hear. $16 billion. That's how much money in refunds the IRS flagged for possible identity fraud. Here's another one. One in four honest, hardworking, taxpaying Americans has been a victim of identity theft. But it's not all grim news. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second for your personal information and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock's U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, backed by another good number, the $1 Million Protection Package. In fact, restoration is guaranteed or your money back. Don't face identity theft and financial losses alone. There's strength in numbers with LifeLock Identity Theft Protection for tax season and beyond. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 40% your first year. That's 40% off at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Pepsi Prebiotic Cola in original and cherry vanilla. That Pepsi taste you love with no artificial sweeteners, only 30 calories, just 5 grams of sugar, and 3 grams of prebiotic fiber. That great Pepsi taste with even more to love. Pepsi Prebiotic Cola. Unbelievably Pepsi.
It seems to me that there's more of a light being shined on missing and murdered Indigenous women literally in the last 6 months to a year. Do you think so? The Gabby Petito case was, which is obviously another, you know, blonde hair, white girl who went missing. Do you think that that case actually helped bring more attention? Because at first there was like outrage that because not that her case didn't deserve attention, but we've talked about it with several guests on this show that it was like, OK, why is this one white girl getting all this national attention when there's all these from the same area missing and murdered Indigenous women that nobody's talking about? So if first came outrage, but it seems to me that because of that outrage, it seems to have brought some attention. And at least from where I'm at, I'm hearing more and more about these cases and people working on them now. Would you agree with that? Or do you think?
I remember when Gabby first went missing, and I remember just feeling so terrible because, again, there were so many similarities I felt between her and Jermaine Charlotte. Like, the first season of Stolen is about the disappearance of a young Indigenous woman named Jermaine Charlotte. And she was a mother of two, and she went missing from downtown Missoula And our first season is like a deep dive into her unsolved case and really trying to help people get to know Jermaine through her family that remembers her and misses her and loves her and is desperate to find her still. But also helping to kind of shine a light on these broader systemic issues that make Indigenous women more likely to be victims of violence. And Jermaine, like when Gabby went missing, I remember like, you know, I think that a big part of Gabby's disappearance and the reason that it got so much attention was because of how active she was on social media and how like present she was on that. And Jermaine was the same way. Jermaine was on TikTok. She made these videos. That was actually one of the reasons that her family was, you know, was concerned about her right away, was because like, oh, she hasn't posted anything and we can't get a hold of her. Like, this is so unlike Jermaine. And I remember thinking about like how that social media attention then kind of turned into this like online support around Gabby's disappearance, which then translated into media attention, which then translated into police investigation. Like this, you know, the attention around her case, like there was coordination across state lines from multiple police forces who were looking for Gabby and working on this investigation. And it happened like so fast. It was like within days and within, you know, of her disappearance, there was this like coordinated support. And with Jermaine, like she went missing and her family was immediately worried because she was absent on social media. And they were also dealing with different police jurisdictions because like so many tribal communities, they have this kind of patchwork of law enforcement that has jurisdiction over their territories. So she was from the, you know, the reserve, and there were like five counties that are, you know, around that police are sometimes called depending on where you are in the reserve, and there's tribal police. And she went missing in Missoula, so they were dealing with the Missoula City Police, and they couldn't coordinate with each other. Like her family had to go try to get, like it was a struggle to even get her reported as missing. And just seeing like the resources that came out of the Gabby Petito case, it just broke my heart thinking about, if Jermaine had had that kind of coordinated response and that kind of attention, like just what a difference that would have made in her case. And maybe likely, probably, you know, her family wouldn't be here like 4 years after her disappearance, still wondering where she is, still searching for her, still going out on searches in the mountains in their community to try to find her. And it's just, it's true that it, I think it has raised attention, but I always think about the families that didn't get that, the families that didn't get that attention. And there's still so many out there who need it.
Yeah. In Jermaine's case, so that was the case that Connie's talking about here is season one of Stolen. And you guys like joined into that investigation. Do you feel like you were able to at least move the ball forward in the investigation and shine a better light on the case from the work you did?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that we were absolutely like able to shine a spotlight on it. And you know, a lot of our investigation obviously like centered around Jermaine's family and like what they knew and what they were told. But a big part of it was also like one of our biggest sources was Detective Guy Baker, who was the lead investigator in Jermaine's disappearance. And so, you know, he's someone that is really out front in Jermaine's case and really, you know, has showed us the binders that he has, like show all the work he's done on the case. But I think what our investigation did was also kind of point out some of those failures of the investigation and some of the challenges that the police forces faced as a result of her disappearance. And I think for her family, I know that it was important that to tell Jermaine's story, that they have been like pushing that for a long time on their own, trying to get attention, trying to get pressure. But I still think that at the end of the day, they just want to find Jermaine and bring her home. And it's just so frustrating that she's still missing and that they haven't been able to do that.
Are you still in contact with the family after the series aired?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's something that just, you know, I'm still in contact with Cleo's family too, and Alberta Williams' family. The first season of Missing and Murdered was about Alberta Williams' family. And I just talked to her sister Claudia a few weeks ago, and like you know, I think that when you do these kind of in-depth investigations, you get to know people really well, right? And you mm-hmm. spend a lot of time with them, but also like what was so interesting to me, especially about Germaine's case, was that, you know, I remember going and talking to her grandmother, her yaya Vicky, and then talking to her aunts, Belinda and Danny, and realizing like we're in such a unique position as journalists to go in, because it's our job to ask these questions and to like sit down and like ask as many questions as we can. We did like multiple interviews that were hours long. And then in those interviews, you're like, oh, wow, you know, I'm talking about things that I don't know that they have talked about really even with each other yet. Like, because they're dealing with also so many, like they're dealing with their daily lives, they're dealing with their families, but also like they're approaching things from a grieving family point of view. And so they're not necessarily, having the same conversations. And so it's a really like unique position to be in, I think, as a journalist who comes in and then is so involved with families. And absolutely, like Germaine's family, I'm thinking about them, especially like this month. It's you know, they're coming up on another anniversary of Germaine's disappearance. And mm-hmm. I know that's always a really difficult time.
Right. Well, let's move on to talk about our case today, which is the case, the subject of season 2 of Stolen, which just started as of now. I think there's 5 episodes out for season 2.
Hey, episode 5 is out.
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't give the timestamp, but yeah.
Yeah. So maybe when you're listening to this, maybe 6 and 7 are out too. It depends when this airs. Do you know how many episodes are going to be in this season?
At least 8.
At least 8. Okay. So so you'll have something to binge on, listeners, when you listen to this, when this airs. But you have a very personal connection with season 2 of Stolen, and it's, I started listening to it, and it's really interesting. It's not what I was expecting at all. The case is, the Howard Cameron is how it's listed to me, but it's the survivors and the abuse that took place at the St. Michael's school, up where your father was from. But go ahead and break down. So Howard Cameron is actually your dad.
He's my dad. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's my dad.
And share, cause I don't want to give away too much. I'll let you decide what to give away to the audience about the case before they listen.
So it was about a year ago, actually, that I was just scrolling through Facebook one day, and I came across a post that my brother had written about our dad, Howard Cameron. And it was about a story that my dad had shared with my brother about a time when he was a police officer and he was stationed in rural Saskatchewan, which is pretty remote, you know, mm-hmm. in the Canadian prairies. And in the 1970s, he was working as a member of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and he was out on patrol one night. So he saw a vehicle swerving on the highway, and he pulled it over because he suspected the driver was drinking. And when he got up to the driver's side window, he recognized the driver as a priest who had abused him when he was a boy at a residential school. And I don't know how much your audience knows about residential schools, but they had similar things in the United States. They were called boarding schools in the US and residential schools in Canada. But there were these schools that were set up to basically assimilate Indigenous kids. So they were created by the federal government and often run by churches in Canada. They started, some of the first residential schools opened up in like the late 1800s, and they were open for about 100 years in Canada, and Indigenous children went to these schools, and the goal was to assimilate them. You know, my dad went to the school when he was 6 years old, starting in 1961. He spoke Cree, you know, he didn't speak any English. He went to this school. And kids were, you know, they lived at these schools for the entire school year. Some of them were allowed to go home at Christmas or some in summer vacations. Sometimes kids didn't. But there was a lot of terrible abuse that happened at these schools. Like they were called schools, but really the goal was kind of forced assimilation. And so when I read this story about a year ago that my dad had beat up this priest, because that's what happened. He recognized this priest on the side of the road, and then he beat him up on the side of the road. And then he went on to tell my brother this story. And when my brother shared the story on Facebook, it was kind of the first time that I realized like what my dad's experience had been at that school. I didn't know about that before. And it really, I mean, it's very like, it's a very personal podcast, you know,
right.
I talk a lot about my relationship with my dad and how hearing that story really helped me understand him in a way that I never had before and made me want to learn more about his experience at that school, but also made me want to try to find the priest that he pulled over and the priest who abused him. And that's basically the start of this podcast, which is the second season of Stolen.
Now, I know you've speak with over 30 survivors of the abuse at St. Michael's throughout the course of the podcast. Do you start looking into other cases? Is it really focused around this one priest and your dad, or are you investigating everything that went on there?
Yeah, it really like this is such, I feel like it's such a unique like case for us to take on, obviously not just because it's personal and it's about my dad, but it starts out being like really focused on my dad and his experience at this school and trying to find the priest who abused him. But the more we get into it, the kind of deeper we get into this school. And my dad passed away like in 2013. So when I decided to start looking into this school, you know, I obviously couldn't talk to him about his experience, but he was one of 15 kids in his family to go to that school. Mm-hmm. So I started interviewing his brothers and sisters because they all went there. They all went to this school. Most of them went when they were 6 years old, just like my dad. They had very similar experiences. And it wasn't long before I started hearing stories about other priests who were abusive at the school, about priests who were abusive at the school, you know, and getting people's names. And so I really kind of, you know, it's like that old story that you're just, you know, you're just unwinding the yarn, you know, you're just going with it and you don't know where it's going to go. And this podcast like really kind of builds and builds in a way. And, you know, I don't know, but like we're still working on the episodes as they're rolling out. So like I'll tell you guys, but like we just like episode 5 came out today and like we just finished it last night, basically.
I'm so happy to hear that. That's my world. That's where I live. I'm still working on this Friday's episode. It's Tuesday.
I know. It's like, I mean, it's obviously it's intense, but I think it also helps illustrate like just how, you know, we're still digging, we're still reporting, we're still investigating the school. And it definitely does expand. And what we end up trying to do is really try to get a sense of, just how widespread the abuse was at this school. So like in one of my very first conversations with one of my dad's brothers, they tell me about another person in our family who was also sexually abused by a priest. And they tell me the name of this priest that my uncle Ivan accused of sexual abuse. And then we start investigating this priest and we find out he's still alive. And we start talking to other survivors and hearing more allegations against him. And then we like, I don't know how far you've gotten, Bob, but I don't want to give you any spoilers, but it basically like it becomes, you know, a much bigger investigation. And we end up wanting to try to find out just how widespread the abuse was at the school, how many people were abusing children there. And what we uncover is really kind of, I mean, it's disturbing and staggering. And I don't even say that as a family member, like who had people in my family go to the school and experience this abuse directly, but just as a journalist, like that, you know, this is kind of, it's kind of shocking to say, I think, that in 2022, like that this is the first time there's been this kind of investigation into St. Michael's and into a residential school like this in Canada. But this is where we're at. Like it's so, there's also this urgency. It's so important to hear these stories now because survivors are, you know, they're getting old and this truth is going to be lost if we don't ask the questions and tell these stories now.
Yeah, I'm loving it so far. It has that real, like, real time feel that you're kind of going through the process with you as you're digging through it. And I do think it's super important for these stories to come out, because, you know, there are people being abused, children being abused right now as we speak that are going through the same thing. And I think the more and more we can normalize coming forward and telling their stories, the better chance we have of putting an end to that. Have you gotten any kind of pushback from the church or anything?
Yeah, we've been in touch with, so the school that my dad went to was run by this Catholic order of priests called the Oblates of Mary Immaculate. And they're obviously like an order of male priests that originated in France. And they ran 48 residential schools in Canada. And so we have been in touch with them to tell them about our investigation and to ask them questions and to try to get information, you know, because they ran this school for about 80 years. And so it was like generations of children, obviously, who went to the school. My dad was the third generation in his family to go. And they ran this, these priests ran the school the entire time. And because they were, essentially hired by the federal government to run this school, to open this school and to run this school, they had to report back to the federal government. So they kept a lot of records from the school, like attendance records. I went back and I found my dad's admission form, both of his parents were at the school. I found their attendance reports, their parents, so my great grandparents, my great grandfather was one of the actually first students at the school, in the early 1900s. We've been talking to the Oblates. I think that the first email with them, the provincial superiors of the head of the Oblates in Canada thanked me for my investigation and apologized, to families who experienced abuse at residential schools and kind of reiterated their commitment to reconciliation, which is a really, it's a different tone than we're reading about.
Sure.
Because when survivors first started coming forward and telling stories about the abuse they experienced in residential schools, this is happening in the 90s. It really kind of started happening in the 90s. And they started suing the federal government and the churches, including the Oblates, for the abuse they experienced in the schools. And back then, we found some of those original lawsuits that survivors were filing. And, back then the Oblates were saying, they deny any allegations of abuse. They deny being responsible for the care of children in these schools. They deny, employing this one priest in particular that we were asking about, and they deny having any authority over him. And they said that even if the abuse was found to have occurred, even if it's proven to be true, which these lawsuits, a lot of them actually never even went forward, that it was actually the responsibility of the Canadian government, not the Oblates, who ran the school. So it's been a real journey of it feels like it's a real time investigation into very recent history, but also kind of really it's helped me realize how much of what we know or what we think we know about things about our history are really written by the people who have the power at the time. And I feel like so much of my work, not just in this season of Stolen, has been about trying to correct the record and trying to give Indigenous people the agency and voice and space to kind of correct the record and to share our version of this shared history, which has been underreported, ignored.
Yeah, I'd say more closer to ignored. Well, I think it's great that you're doing it. You're doing a fantastic job and have been. I mean, you're a pro. It's obvious all the way from I've heard some of your Missing and Murdered and stolen. In this story, I'm very excited to see how this ends up playing out as it moves along. Her name is Connie Walker, and the podcast is called Stolen. They are, as of now, 5 episodes into season 2. By the time you hear this, you may be able to binge the entire season. So check it out. Could be your next big true crime binge. Connie, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with me today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
It's tax season, and by now, we're all a bit tired of numbers. But here's an important one you need to hear. $16 billion. That's how much money in refunds the IRS flagged for possible identity fraud. But it's not all grim news. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. If your identity is stolen, they'll fix it. Guaranteed. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Here's the truth. You could literally be adored by everyone and then come home and still get completely ignored by your own cat. It's classic cat behavior. But new Shiba Premium Puree is a lickable treat that changes all that. They're protein-rich, made with bone broth, and have the smooth, creamy texture cats go crazy for, especially when it's hand-fed. Yeah, it's more than a treat. It's a fast pass to favorite human status. So feed your cat Shiba and go from totally ignored to truly adored in just 12 days, guaranteed, or your money back. Learn more at Shiba.com.